and I should also thank the organizers for putting up this fun event and giving me the chance to share our story. So for those of you who were there in Liu Jin's talk yesterday, this will be, as Nandini said, an expansion with hopefully more concrete examples. And for those of you who weren't, don't worry, I'll make it self-contained. Okay, so the problem I want to talk about, in full generality, you can say it's the problem of immergibility. It can be roughly be phrased as follows. So given some UV system, right, typically for condensed matter physicists, we're thinking of a lattice of spins or a lattice of electrons. And we make some rules how we want, for example, the Hamiltonian to be local, and there are some symmetries like spin rotation or lattice symmetries. So we make those rules. But I do not specify the Hamiltonian except by requiring that it's local and symmetric. Okay. This is, of course, motivated by the very real situation that in real life, there are a zillion different materials. They all have their own Hamiltonian, and very often we don't actually know exactly what the Hamiltonian is anyway. So that's my UV. So some spin system. For this talk, let me be concrete. Let me just think about a lattice spin. So lattice with local Hamiltonian and some symmetry. And then there are my IR theory. And for this talk, let me be a little bit more concrete and say, when I think about IR theory, I'm thinking about some field theory that's conformal invariant, right? Just think about some critical states of matter. But if you like, you can pick your favorite choice of IR theory, right? You can think about some TQFD, you can think about some crazier stuff, right? Doesn't matter. And you know, the problem of immergibility is that given the UV and the IR, I ask, could this happen, right? Meaning that could this IR theory, for example, my CFT, emerge as the low energy, effective low energy description of my UV system for some choice of Hamiltonian, right? So could it happen? So let me give you a more concrete example, just to so you know exactly what I'm talking about. So let me think about a spin half chain. So it's a 1D Hamiltonian system with a 1D lattice, and on every lattice site, I have a spin half moment, right? Kind of the simplest thing you want to play with. So that's my UV. And in the IR, I want to talk about the SU2 level 1 CFT. Right, it's some type of Luttinger liquid, right, some critical states. And I want to ask, you know, for a 1D spin chain preserving the, for example, the SO3 spin rotation symmetry and translation symmetry with some local Hamiltonian, could the SU2 level 1 CFT emerge as the low energy description? And most of you probably know that the answer is, of course, yes. And there are many different approaches developed for this problem successfully. So right. So I'll name at least three or four. So the first one, the oldest one, actually, is you just solve a Hamiltonian, right? It turns out there is. So for this problem, I just ask if there is exists a Hamiltonian. But you know, if you can find a Hamiltonian and exactly solve it, of course you're in good shape. And this nearest neighbor Heisenberg model is well known to be exactly solved by beta ansatz. Right. and it looks like SU2 level one. So there's, you know, once you have that solution, there's no doubt on that problem whatsoever, right? But let's nevertheless talk about some other approaches, right? So what you can also do is you can approximately map a lattice spin Hamiltonian or a lattice theory to some continuum field theory, or some continuum Lagrangian, okay. The two examples come to mind. One is the sigma model approach. Right, you can semi-classically expand your Hamiltonian, put it, go through the spin coherence state path integral, and end up with some sigma model, nonlinear sigma model with topological term. Right, that's what Duncan Haldane did in the 80s. Or you can go through a trick that many condensed matter physicists like, which is known as the parton construction. It's a bag of tricks that allows you to map a lattice spin system to essentially a lattice gauge theory, and then you take the continuum limit without fully justifying the limit anyway, and then you end up with some continuum gauge theory. Okay, and you've seen this example on Monday from Fokker's talk, in which case you map this to a 1+1D QED. Is there a question? Or? All right, no. All right. Okay, so that's another approach, which has also been very successful. And the third approach I want to talk about today is anomaly matching. Right. So both this both the approach one and approach two involve some level of massaging the lattice Hamiltonian, right? Either exactly or approximately. But in the third approach, I don't have a Hamiltonian to deal with. I just calculate anomaly, right? So yes, the talk is about what the third is, but yeah.
Is there some way that this would not have worked if I maintained the symmetry of all the symmetries?
Rajmani.
Yeah, it might help. Can you say it again?
Do you have an example, you know, where I put down a theory on the lattice, it has all the right symmetries that you are expecting, but it does not produce the conformal field theory?
Oh, lots of examples, right? So
why does that happen?
Well, actually, if you randomly pick up a lattice Hamiltonian, it does something else. It probably does, I don't know, spontaneous symmetry breaking, or it develops a gap in the IR, and all kinds of things could happen, right? So
this is what confuses me. I think probably Shailesh will agree with me too. If we are thinking about, say, example that I know really well, QCD, we always say there is only, it's all in the same universal study class. It doesn't matter what action I write down, I will get the same IR. So that's why I'm confused. I mean, I can understand if there are many.
The key is for all the system, we never properly take the continuum limit. It, you know, the coupling constants at the lattice scale, they're never small. They're always order one. So when we say in the continuum or in the IR, you get a conformal field theory, it's in terms of universality class, right? It's you know, so that's why if, you know,
okay,
for example, I can imagine adding some funnier term, right? Actually, Anders talked about this.
Next,
right, and if I crank up this J prime enough, I actually get something totally different. Right. So, yeah. So in general, on the lattice, the universality class, applies only to a finite, at most to a finite window of coupling constant. Yes, Shailesh.
Here's
another. How will you count? You need two hands.
Okay, so from the RG perspective, right? So you're right that if I just choose some Hamiltonian with some couplings. Maybe it's gabbed, maybe it's in some other phase, but at least from the RG perspective, can you guarantee that if you can, you will find some model somewhere with playing around, that there will be a fixed point where the original theory would emerge, or is that also something that cannot be?
So, in some sense, that is the question, right? What is the necessary and sufficient condition, mm-hmm. right? That some theory can emerge if you tune enough stuff, right?
We don't want to tune infinite stuff. The question is, are there some finite number of parameters you can?
Yeah. And that is the question, basically. Yeah.
So you're saying it's just folklore that if there is rough locality and the right symmetries, you're not guaranteed that the continuum limit is possible.
Oh, that's not a folklore. That's demonstrably true, right? It's when you do get what you want, you have to justify it. Yeah, it's a surprise. As I said, a priori, you can write down, like, I don't know, 10 different terms here, and they all do their different thing. Right. So that's why I phrased the question as, does there exist one? Right. I'm not trying to solve a particular Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So this is what I'll be focusing on today. And very roughly speaking, I'll justify I'll tell you more about it, what this means, but roughly speaking, we want to match the two Hooft anomaly in the IR and in the UV. And the working assumption is that this will suffice. But before going into a little bit more detail on how it works for this particular example, let me just make a side comment that if I go from approach one to approach two, all the way to approach three, the level of rigor decreases monotonically, right? Actually quite badly. But what you gain is generalizability. This one goes up, right? Because if I go to more complicated cases, especially in higher dimension, let's say I take a 2D lattice spin system, then unless you're Kitai, otherwise your Hamiltonian is most likely not solvable. That's why for many of us in the community, a lot of our time is spent on approach two. Yes? Sorry?
Here.
I couldn't hear you. You need a mic.
Yeah, I'm asking, is two more rigorous than three?
Depending on your taste. I mean, if two approaches are both non-rigorous, it's not clear if rigor has a definition on the real line.
Okay.
But I guess probably most people will agree that most people will be more comfortable having approach two than approach three.
Just one point of rigor. No, the notion of rigor. There is mathematical rigor, physical rigor, conceptual rigor. If you talk Eliotly, this rigor is very different from your rigor. So, condensed matter physics.
Guys, if you want to be heard.
Sorry. In condensed matter physics, we are living in an experimental world. So if there is a rigorous connection with experiments, then it's very good. So I just wanted to remain that. So rigor, you insist on rigor and generalizability. To me, many spin Hamiltonians lead me to a rich world. For example, the one-dimensional spin chain, it takes you to the solvable Haldane-Majumdar-Ghosh model, and another fixed point corresponding to Haldane-Shastri. So I think there is a lot of scope for playing with the first thing itself. Whereas somebody well-trained in field theory may like the third one. Anyway, I just wanted to talk about rigor. Yeah. Conceptual rigor is very important in condensed matter physics. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I should also remark that even though approach two seems to work, actually very often reasonably well. In fact, if you go to, let's say, fractional quantum Hall effect, it works amazingly well, better than it has any right to be. But, you know, after a while, we want to do something else and see if it's possible to go beyond it. In particular, there seem to be examples where approach two may even not be an option. So I'll briefly mention some examples we found later, the second part of my talk. Okay. Okay. So now let me move on to tell you what this actually looks like for this particular example. Okay. So let me try to be a little bit more precise for this in this context. Exactly what I mean by UV and IR, right? So let me first talk about UV. So I have my Hilbert space, which is a tensor product of a lattice. Let's say I goes from 1 to L. L is my system size. So it's a tensor product of on-site local Hilbert spaces. And on each site, the local Hilbert space is just a spin half moment, right? So it's a span of spin up on site I and spin down on site I. Okay. And the Hamiltonian, as I said, I did not specify it, except to say that it's local, which means it's a sum of local stuff around site I. Okay. And the symmetry, which is very important in my story. So here, I mean, when I say symmetry in the UV, it's exact symmetry at the lattice scale. So I call it GUV. For this one, let me keep it somewhat simple. Let me just keep SO3, the spin rotation symmetry, and translation. So it's a lattice, so the translation is discrete translation. The group structure, if you like, is a Z. So let me put it in an X just to remind you that it's translation in the X direction. So this is generated by the unitary translation operator TX. So it's TX to the N for any integer N. So that's part of the group. I could have put in more stuff. I could have put in reflection symmetry. I could have put in time reversal symmetry. We know how to do all those things. But just for simplicity, let me just talk about these two symmetries.
Your symmetries have to be global or can they be global?
They have to be global. They have to be real symmetry. Yeah.
And is it necessary that it's a periodic lattice?
If you want to have translation symmetry perfectly well defined, you need a periodic. All right, so that's my UV. And now let me specify my IR theory. So as I already mentioned, for the IR theory, I want to consider the SU2 level 1 CFT. In principle, the most universal data are things like the operator spectrum, the scaling dimension of operators, and their OPE coefficient and so on. But, you know, let me just represent it using a continuum Lagrangian. Right? It works just equally fine. For this particular CFT, there are many different ways of writing down continuum Lagrangian. I can easily think of like 5 or 6. Maybe there are more. Let me use one that would be just convenient for me. So let me think about the O3 vector nonlinear sigma model. With a theta term at theta equal to pi. So the continuum action, let me call it S theta equal to pi, is this one. So just for convenience, let me just do it in Euclidean time. So it's 1 plus 1d. So there's my kinetic term. This n hat is a three-dimensional unit vector. And the theta term, which looks like this. Partial x1 n hat cross partial x2 n hat. Okay. Where n hat lives on S2. Right, so it's a three-dimensional unit vector. It's basically representing my lattice. It's a continuum limit of my lattice spin. Okay. So this is a topological term known as the theta term. If you stare at this expression for a while, in case you're not familiar, you realize that this is just measuring the area swiped by this vector field n hat in my two-dimensional spacetime. So if you integrate over a closed two-dimensional spacetime, this is an integer. It's just measuring how many times I've cut my n hat has covered the whole sphere. Okay. So that's my IR CFT. But there's another piece of data that I should really specify. So for this theory, there's an IR symmetry, right, which is, if you like, you can call it emergent symmetries in the IR. There's an O3, essentially, which takes n hat to O n hat, where O is an O3 matrix. In fact, it can be larger. It can be even be SO4 or O4T. But don't worry about those. For our purpose, O3 is enough. Okay. And so there is another a piece of information which is crucial for even specifying what I mean by IR theory, which is how does the UV symmetry act in my IR theory? So you have to specify that. Well, as I said, the UV symmetry is SO3 and translation, which is Z. And staring at this, it's kind of obvious that SO3 should just basically just rotate my three-component vector. So it goes to O n hat, where this O is in SO3. So my n hat is a vector under SO3. Not too surprising. But another crucial piece of information is that if I think about my lattice translation, or Tx, it takes n hat to minus n hat. Okay. Now, people can actually derive it. But for now, let me just say I want to just define my IR theory this way and see if it works. But in fact, people can derive it. And in fact, the intuition for this n going to minus n under translation is also very simple. It's just saying that this is anti-ferromagnetic fluctuation. Right, so it's primarily, it's going to be up, down, up, down. But for now, just take it as given and see if it works. Okay. And that's the spirit of what I want to talk about.
Is significant that you have an O3 acting in the IR and an SO3
Sorry, I missed the last sentence. Can you say it again?
So is it important that you're distinguishing SO3 from O3?
Oh yeah, absolutely, because this thing is part of O3.
Right.
Yeah. That's Yes, we allow a certain UV symmetry element to act trivially in the IR. Right. Oh, okay. So sorry. There is one piece I should mention, which is when I say this, technically I lied a little bit because you will notice that technically it should also involve a translation that takes my coordinate x to x plus a, where a is my lattice constant. But if I assume that the continuum limit makes sense, this thing I should view it as pretty much the same as x. Right. So in some sense, I have internalized the lattice symmetry. Right. So that lattice symmetry acts just as an internal symmetry, just ordinary global internal symmetry by multiplying the n by a phase.
Is it okay for me to think that if you took the continuum limit there, the one extra symmetry that survives is then going to minus n?
Yes. Yes. So the more systematic way to say this kind of thing is to say that my GUV embeds into GIR, right? And this kind of group embedding is described by a group homomorphism. By the way, if I write this, can you actually see? Okay, so it's described by a group homomorphism from GUV to GIR. And in this case, the homomorphism is quite simple, right? It's a homomorphism from, let's say, SO3 cross Z to O3. But remember, O3 is really just SO3 cross Z2. Right? For all dimensions, you don't worry about the non-commutativity. So the embedding is, or the group homomorphism is very simple. SO3 maps to O3 and Z maps to Z2 with the obvious embedding. Okay? So this group homomorphism or the group embedding is a crucial piece of my IR information. Right? Without specifying what that is, I haven't told you the full IR theory. Okay, so now I finally set up the stage to actually talk about anomaly, what I mean by that. So in case if you are not super familiar with the Hooft anomaly, the entire business of anomaly can be summarized into one short sentence, which is basically what anomaly means, approximately, but it's mostly true, is that flux carries non-trivial charge. Some non-trivial. Typically, non-trivial means fractional. Okay, I put in some twist boundary condition or symmetry flux, monopole, or whatever flux you like, there will be some non-trivial charge showing up. Okay. So let's be a little bit more specific. Let me first talk about the UV anomaly, which is what lives on the lattice. Well, it's a chain of spin halves. So where does the anomaly come from? Well, you notice a very simple fact, which is if I have a system, let's say I have my Hilbert space that lives on size L, right? This is my total number of sites. And I compare that with the system on size, let's say L plus one. There's a crucial difference, which is all states here differ from all states here by half integer spin. You can't get rid of that half integer spin. Let's say if L is even, then all states here carry integer spin, and then L plus one is odd, so here every state has half integer spin. Okay. It's a trivial fact. It's trivial, but it's profound, right? Because if you think in terms of more in terms of symmetry flux, let me draw this picture. So imagine I have my spin chain, just put it on the ring, and I go around this ring. Like I travel through my entire space once. So going around the space, right? Meaning a full cycle. This involves, almost by definition, a lattice translation by L times. Right. If you are thinking about parallel transport, you're on track. Which means if I compare system size L and L plus 1, the L plus 1, when I travel through my entire space, involves one extra lattice translation. Right. Again, almost sound trivial. But then you have to recall, just repeating that sentence, right? You know, when I travel through my space cycle, I got acted by Tx, by the translation, one more time. Well, that's essentially the definition of asymmetry flux in 1D, right? So recall that a symmetry flux, let's say a G flux, let's say this little g is, let's say, an element in my symmetry group, simply means that I pick up a G action when going around my cycle, right? So it means picking up a G action when going around the flux. Right. Think of twisted boundary condition. Right. Let's say if I have a Z2 symmetry, I twist my boundary condition. Oh, okay. So which means my L plus one system compared to my L system has an extra translation symmetry flux. But as I also mentioned, the difference of these two is that one carries half integer spin, the other carries integer spin. So if you combine these two seemingly two very simple fact, you reach the conclusion that a translation flux carries half integer spin. That matches with my definition of anomaly here. Some flux carries some non-trivial charge. Okay. So that's the UV anomaly. Now let me talk about the IR anomaly. Right. Essentially, the game now is hopefully becoming clearer, which is take this IR theory with this group embedding, see if this condition is satisfied. That's it. So how does it work? So as already illustrated there, for this definition of IR theory, the translation symmetry Z acts as a Z2 subgroup of my O3 symmetry, O3 IR symmetry, right? So in the IR theory, Zx takes n hat to minus n hat. So a flux of translation symmetry when acting on my IR theory is really just a flux, you know, if you like, an anti-symmetric, an anti-periodic boundary condition for this n hat, right? It's a twist. So the the translation flux acts as a domain wall, if you like, across which this n hat flips sign.
I can think of this n hat to minus n hat as basically like time reversal or
something? Not quite, it's unitary. It doesn't involve...
Okay, yeah, it's right.
Yeah, but in fact this...
But it's a crucial you're at theta equals pi for that reason, right? Because otherwise you're like...
Exactly. Because I have this symmetry, theta has to be either 0 or pi.
Right.
Otherwise I can tune my theta continuously. Yeah.
So it's like time reversal.
It's very similar to the FOHF, for example. 3 plus 1. Yeah, this theory also has time reversal, and there are similar stories, but I'm just not mentioning those for simplicity. Okay, so it's essentially a Z2 flux, a domain wall. But then you can say, okay, I have my Lagrangian, I can study what this domain wall does. Right? Everything is perfectly well defined. Oh, this piece doesn't do anything really interesting, right? At most, you get some energy cost because you know it's manifestly invariant under n going to minus n. But this piece, if you just stare at it, right, it involves 3n. So under n goes to minus n, it flips sign. So normally, if you're on a closed manifold and you just flip the sign of n everywhere, it's not an issue because this pi goes to minus pi. But you know because this whole thing is quantized to integer pi and minus pi. I mean, the theta angle, well, we call it theta, that's because it's compact, it's periodic. Theta is equivalent to theta plus 2 pi, so pi and minus pi are the same thing. Right, so we don't worry about that. But if I have a domain wall where, if you think about it, this is my domain wall, where on half of the space I flip the n, then I have a situation where on this half, I have theta equal to pi, but on this half, I have theta equal to minus pi. And then there's a domain wall there. Well, the domain wall actually is also very easy to get once you realize that theta equal to pi means that theta equals to pi is theta equal to minus pi is theta equal to pi minus 2 pi. Right, so this action is doing nothing but to add a theta equal to minus 2 pi term. Essentially, I just copy that, this I 2 pi over 4 pi square n hat dot partial n hat cross partial n hat. So add this term, but only on half of the space. All right. So now let me just write it out more explicitly. The integration, there's a dt, but then there's also a dx, which the x only runs, let's say, from 0 to infinity. It's no longer running through the whole space. But this may look familiar, at least to most of you, because if you've seen the path integral representation in the spin coherent basis of a single spin, that's it. That's your path integral representation of a single spin moment. In fact, the coefficient is such that you have a spin 1/2. Right. So if you like, this is the 0 plus 1 dy sub Witten term for the O3 spin. Okay. So this is nothing but a spin 1/2 moment on the domain wall. And in particular, because it's spin 1/2, in the IR theory, all my fields, which is like n hat transform in integer spin, so n hat is a vector. Finite number of n hat only makes an integer spin. This 1/2 spin cannot be screened, so it will just be there. And this is exactly what I wanted, right? Remember, I just want a translation flux, which is really just a fancy way of saying one extra unit cell, to carry a half integer spin. And this checks out. Okay. Sorry. So the anomaly matches, and of course, how am I doing on time?
Actually, if you find a good place to start.
Yeah, okay, this might be a good place to pause. I have a few more comments on this, but let me do the comments for the second part. Right. So yeah, I'll open to questions.
So, question on this symmetry embedding.
Yeah.
So you said something like antiferromagnet, and then it's very usual that it's very obvious that when you do some lattice translation, then you flip the sign of n. But when I think of some ferromagnet, then it's not so obvious anymore. Can you comment on that?
Exactly. Actually, this is part of the comments I was going to make, but since you asked anyway, you can ask the following question. Since I didn't try to derive it from any microscopic model, can I just play, mess around with it and say, I want my IR to be SU2 level 1, everything same here, except under translation, n hat just goes to n hat without the minus sign, right? You won't see any immediate inconsistency. It's fine, right? And then you ask, okay, could it possibly be realized on the spin half chain if I mess around with my Hamiltonian, right? I know that if I take the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model, it's not going to happen, just people derive that. But imagine having some crazy Hamiltonian, I don't know, S dot S times S dot S, some 8-spin interaction, blah, blah, blah. Could that ever happen? Now, this argument is telling you that it won't, right? Because the anomaly won't match, right? But in fact, if there is no such anomaly, for example, if my unit cell contains integer spin, then there is no UV anomaly. And then this theory could, in principle, arise. And in fact, it does arise. This is specifically in spin one chain. That theory will be describing the critical point between the Haldane AKLT chain and the topologically trivial gapped spin chain. So it does arise there. So, yeah.
But what about the critical point in the spin one? Would it match? Would the anomaly match?
Yeah, there. Yeah. That critical point, the anomaly match because the anomaly is kind of trivial on both sides, in the UV and in the IR. Yeah. Yes.
Naively, I would have thought if I just did the lattice model without making the connection to the continuum, I might have seen a different large, when L goes to infinite, the limit for even L might come out to be different than odd L.
Yes.
Something that you would not expect thermodynamically, but in this case, it happens. Is that part of what's going on?
It sort of is. It's saying that even in the thermodynamic limit, there is some difference between odd L and even L. It will manifest as some kind of defect.
So is there a difference between the ground state energy?
That probably no. The in terms of energy, I think, or energy density, if you like, I think that vanishes, at least to some power of 1 over L or something.
Yeah.
So. This, yeah.
More questions? Okay.
Yeah.
I want to ask a really naive question. I'm confused by the statement flux carries charge.
Yeah.
And flux carries half integer spin.
Yeah.
How is half integer spin a charge?
It's charge meaning non-trivial representation under some symmetry.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
Similar arguments work if the lattice model is given by some kind of a continuous field.
They have to form some non-trivial rep of the symmetry, right? That's the important thing. Otherwise, As long as you can get that done. For example, you can imagine a situation where the lattice, you can have spin 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, blah blah blah. As long as you make sure all of them are half integer spin, this will go through. Fucker. Oh, no, this is the correct CFT. It's just the O3 symmetry is not the whole story.
Exactly. So, can you see that there's that I mean, this should not match. I mean, there's something.
Oh, it does match. That's the thing. In fact, yeah, the O3 anomaly of this Lagrangian matches with the SO4 anomaly of the 4SU2 level 1. Right. So, if you like, this is more like a mid IR. It's not deep enough. You have to let the G to flow to the critical value to have the full SO4. So yeah. Yeah, I'm just using the O3 because it's simpler. Yeah.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, thanks.
Coffee break, let's thank you.